thank you very much for giving us a few minutes here. I'm here with Dean Bortel, and this is the Smoke and Mirrors Hours on the Millennium Growth Broadcast Network. And, you know, you are obviously are one of the experts in this whole research area of medical marijuana. And we really appreciate you giving us a few minutes of your time today. For the listener that may have been under a rock for the last 6 months and not seen any of the CNN special or read any of the news, can you give us a little bit of your background, how you got involved with PTSD and cannabis, and you know, just a little bit about you?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a physician. I practice internal medicine and psychiatry here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I've been taking care of veterans now for about 20 years in my private practice, and these guys have, you know, slowly been reporting to me over about the last 10 years that they've learned how to successfully use marijuana to manage a lot of their medical ailments, not just PTSD, but a variety of conditions. And as I've told you before, that I was highly skeptical. I've trained in a very conservative medical model where we learn to only covet medications that are approved by the FDA. And so for me to hear all these reports about patients claiming to get benefit out of this plant, I was very dubious, and I, you know, continued to abide by my training, which is to believe that marijuana is a harmful, dangerous, addictive drug that we need to persuade our patients to stop using. And so that's what happened, was slowly the veterans, more and more vets were coming out of the shadows talking about their experiences with marijuana. And I finally, it took me years to finally start listening to them and realizing, not just to the patients, but also their family members, who were very credible historians talking about how patients had had really benefited and were carefully, successfully, you know, judiciously using this plant to manage, particularly their PTSD, though, seemed to be one of the more responsive, you know, one of the illnesses that seemed to, it was surprising to me, because with PTSD being such a complex syndrome, usually in psychiatry we need to treat it with 5, 6, 10 different medicines sometimes in order to get it under control to the point where patients are stable. But yet patients are reporting that they, with a single intervention, they were using marijuana as monotherapy to manage the entire constellation of PTSD symptoms. And and so anyway, I at least felt like, even though I continue to be skeptical, and I, you know, as a scientist, I always strive for objective data, and we don't consider, you know, patient reports are considered subjective information that includes human bias. So my goal has always been to try to collect objective data on how this plant can possibly help PTSD, and if it does help, then what strains are best for this illness. And so that's what we designed this study back in 2010, and, you know, it was submitted to the FDA, and then in April of 2011 we actually received FDA approval. And so this was a phase 2 randomized controlled trial looking at 4 different strains of smoked marijuana for veterans with PTSD. And so this was a real breakthrough, because this is the first and only study in the world of a randomized controlled trial looking at whole plant marijuana for PTSD. So it's really important. But I always just felt we had a duty to these veterans to at least put the plant through the rigors of the FDA drug development process, rather than just the medical community constantly dismissing these veterans' claims and insisting these are just, you know, drug abusers that are trying to get high. I felt we have a moral duty to them to, if there's a chance that this plant could reduce human suffering, and it was being instead forced to sit on the shelf, is being constantly vilified, I felt I had a duty. You know, and as a physician who, you know, as an AMA member and part of that, you know, the AMA code of ethics says that we are required to abide by the laws of this country, but we're also required to change laws that we believe are not are detrimental to our patients. And that's why I've become so politically active over the last, because as soon as I realized, you know, the truth is that here we are, since the study was submitted in 2010, here we are 5 years later, still unable to implement this very critical research, even though we're fully funded, we have all the federal government approvals. We're, you know, we're, what's holding us back now is this DEA monopoly, what we previously called the NIDA monopoly, the fact that the National Institute on Drug Abuse has a government-enforced monopoly on the only legal supply of marijuana for any of these FDA-approved trials. So now we've been waiting 17 months for marijuana study drug, and I still have no timeline for when that marijuana will arrive here. So it's very, very frustrating, because any other Schedule I drug, they don't have to deal with all these barriers. It's easier for me to study heroin, LSD, MDMA, because I can buy, you know, research-grade MDMA from any lab in the country. Only marijuana has this bizarre, you know, single monopoly where we have to go through an agency that has gone on record to say that they already, you know, that they believe they only want to fund or greenlight studies that are looking at harmful side effects of marijuana or addiction potential of marijuana. So typically studies like ours that dare to say we want to look at effectiveness of marijuana, these studies are relentlessly stonewalled by the government. But we've been very fortunate to have so much public support behind us that they've, you know, we've managed to get through a myriad of, you know, piles and piles of government red tape over. We've been fighting, though, every day for 5 years. We've never relented, and we will persevere until this study is finally implemented. It may still be another few months before we get marijuana, but we will not stop until we're finally screening veterans and enrolling them in the study.
Dr. Cicely, this is Dean Bortel here. I want to first say, as a disabled veteran, thank you very much for what you're trying to do for my brothers and sisters, not necessarily me, as I'm not being treated for PTSD. I am a disabled veteran. I'm a traumatic brain injury survivor. So I do go through many of the same clinics at the VA, as you may or may not, and I'm sure you do know, depending on which region you're in the VA, how they have their specialists set up is quite different. For instance, in Dallas, I didn't have to go through mental health to get to the neurologist. I was simply told that it'd be a year before you could get to a neurologist, so you need to go outside. Here in Colorado, you go through mental health, and this is getting me to my question. I was talking, my daughter is Alexis Bortel. She's an intractable epileptic. I myself am not a patient, but medical cannabis, whole plant specifically, THC oil and CBD, has saved her life. No question in my mind. And so my question to you is when I was talking to the psychiatrist at the VA, I asked him specifically about, you know, medical cannabis, because that's one of the questions I ask you. Do you use any, quote, illicit drugs? And, you know, when the VA is talking to you, they mean cannabis. You know, I don't even think they care about any of the others, because it seems like they focus on cannabis. And I was like, I'm not, I said, but my daughter is. And that the tone in the room changed when I said that. But he said, you know, it's interesting. I asked him about how many veterans were actually using this, and I want to see if this number makes sense to you. He said that almost half of his patients used medical cannabis.
Can you believe it? Yeah. I think that number's probably a low estimate. I say, you know, the veterans I've taken care of over the last two decades, almost all of them have at least utilized it periodically. May not be daily users, but so many of them have taught, you know, each other how to use the plant successfully to manage a variety of medical conditions. So I think it's interesting. At least he acknowledged that to you. That's already a start. It's just sad that, you know, I don't know if Sebastian's told you our frustrations. We're not even allowed to do a simple lecture at the Phoenix VA hospital to talk about a federally legal study. This PTSD research, we'd like to educate the medical staff about the fact that this study is happening in their backyard and will be enrolling veterans with PTSD, and would they be, interested in referring patients to us, and we can't even get a Grand Rounds lecture scheduled there, even though they allowed us to do that 3 years ago. Now they won't because they're so afraid of the word marijuana, even in the context of an FDA-approved study. It's really sad.
So what would you, you know, as you look at this research, I know I love how you're coming at it from science. There seems to be no preconceptions about where you're going with this. What do you see from the VA? You've kind of hinted on it. They won't even let you talk at a VA facility. So the logical question to you would be, if the VA is not going to cooperate with you, then what is your plan for dealing with them, you know, in this research? How are you going to share it with them?
Yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll continue to find creative ways to educate the public about the fact that this study is getting underway, and here's an 800 number where you can refer a loved one. You know, so we'll have to work through military families and see if family members can refer. You know, certainly they're the best ones to know who in their family is suffering and might be eligible. And it's just a simple screening. You know, that's all we were asking from the VA was that they give, that they make that 800 number known to PTSD patients who are still symptomatic. That's the idea. We're looking for what we call treatment-resistant patients. So these are patients who've already been tried on medications or psychotherapy or both and still suffering. And so these guys, all they would do is call an 800 number, and we would screen them verbally, you know, just see how, if they meet, you know, there's pages and pages of inclusion and exclusion criteria. So we would ask them some basic questions to see if they meet the big ones. And then if they do, then we'd probably invite them over to the study site to do a more in-depth screening and see if they meet all the criteria. But we'll have to screen 500 or 600 veterans in order to find that optimal 76 that meet all the requirements. And then, of course, we put them through informed consent and make sure they understand the risks and benefits of being in the study. And then they decide if they want to enroll or not. And it's a big service to, you know, if for the volunteers who are willing to do this, they don't get paid a lot. And they have to use federal government marijuana, which a lot of people would argue is highly substandard, but, you know, that's what we're required to provide them. So they're going to be, and at some points they're going to be off marijuana. So it could be, you know, really a roller coaster for them. They get 3 weeks of marijuana at a time, and then they're cut off the study drug for 2 weeks. So there's a 2-week abstinence period where a lot of their, you know, if they were getting benefit from the marijuana, their symptoms may relapse during that abstinence period. So we're going to be closely monitoring these guys, but it's a fairly high-risk situation. I would say if veterans who have been using marijuana daily are suddenly, remember, in order to be in the study, you have to have a negative urine drug screen. So already they'll have to wash off their marijuana for a month prior to starting. Then they might get randomized into the placebo group. So they may be getting marijuana that's essentially inert, that has no active cannabinoids in it. So that, you know, so that's possible then that they would be off marijuana for 9 straight weeks. So that's why the screening process is so arduous and so crucial, that we, you know, find the right people who can tolerate this without having a lot of dropouts.
Sue, did you, I know you said something about the phone number. Is it set up already? Is it something you can share with us, or are you still setting it up right now?
Yeah, that's the problem, is until we get marijuana, we're not allowed, the Institutional Review Board, the IRB, that manages all studies on human subjects, does not allow us to advertise or recruit patients until we've officially received the marijuana study drug from NIDA and we've gotten our DEA license in place. So there's still a few more steps we're waiting for. But once we have that, we will definitely share that with, and we're going to, when Dean was asking earlier about how we spread the word, we're going to rely heavily on social media and hope that all these veterans groups that have been so devoted to us, you know, over the last couple of years, if they can help share the information with their brothers and sisters and let them know that, you know, this is going to hopefully be underway soon. And we need this to be the most successful study it can possibly be. You know, the data has to be beyond reproach, and in order to do that, we need vets who can go the distance and stick to, you know, be compliant with the FDA protocol. It's a lot of work. They have to keep personal diaries. They have to come back in every week with their unused marijuana so that we can weigh it. We have to. There's a lot of elements of this, and it requires a big sacrifice from them. But I know these guys are used to making sacrifices, and I get the sense from the veterans who are already calling us. I get probably 100 calls a week here from vets asking about how they can be in the study. So that's great that even without any advertising, we're starting to see immense interest, and these vets are very dedicated. They're prepared to relocate, even if they're out of state. They want to relocate for the 12 weeks and be part of what they feel is you know, groundbreaking research that will really improve the body of, you know, the body of scientific literature.
No, that's great, and we'll be more than happy to do our part here in the show. Once you have the details, we'll be sharing that in every show, if we have to, and on the network here, Millennium Grown Broadcast Network. Can you tell us just a little bit about the study? From what I saw, I believe it's Tucson, Arizona, and then maybe Johns Hopkins. And is there how many vet and what is it? Four different kind of cannabis, or three plus placebo?
That's right. Yeah, so there's 76 veterans total that will be split between two sites, my site here in Phoenix, Arizona, and then the second site at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland. And so we'll be enrolling 38 vets at each site, and we will be administering, yeah, they'll be randomized into one of four treatment arms. So one arm is a high THC marijuana from NIDA. Another is a high CBD. The third arm is a 1-to-1 ratio of, we requested 12% THC, 12% CBD, and NIDA just notified us that they have something around a 7%, 7%. So not even close to what we requested, a blended strain that they created. It's very unfortunate, but sadly, this is what we'll have to work with because this is all they know how to produce. So we're going to, and I'll give you another, the high THC arm, just so you have some idea of the level of incompetence here. The highest THC arm they provide is 12% THC.
Oh, wow.
So that's about half of what veterans are actually able to access either at a dispensary or on the black market. And yet we're doing an efficacy study. We're studying the effectiveness of marijuana using 12% THC. I think a lot of people would argue that that sabotages the study from the beginning. But unfortunately, until we can end the DEA monopoly and require them to license other growers, we're stuck with this very suboptimal study drug. So high CBD arm is 12% CBD with no other cannabinoids, and then the fourth arm is the placebo arm, and that's basically the standard plant that they grow, but they've alcohol washed it, leached out all the cannabinoids, so it's basically inert plant material, although we don't really know that. That's what else is interesting about NIDA marijuana is they don't tell you anything except the THC-CBD ratio. We don't know anything about other cannabinoids that are present. We don't know about about the terpene profile, the flavonoid profile, nothing. So this is very, very frustrating to us who, you know, who we feel a duty to the study subjects to learn as much as we can about what, you know, environment was the marijuana grown in. When I asked them, they claimed it was organic. I said, well, what does that mean? Because, you know, organic can mean a lot of things to different growers. And does that really mean pesticide free? What other element, you know? So this is what's bizarre, is that this agency, NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is happy to accept millions and millions of dollars from taxpayers, but they're not willing to have any real transparency. You know, that drug master file should be open to the public. We paid them, you know, that money is, I mean, that agency is run with taxpayer dollars, and the transparency does not exist, and that's very shameful to me. So I think that the public should be outraged by this, and we need your listeners to start, you know, demanding access to that drug master file and questioning why the DEA is not licensing other growers. And other countries do it. Israel and Canada both license multiple growers to provide marijuana for research. There shouldn't be this situation where one government-enforced monopoly that is a failure. I mean, it would be different if this agency was doing a great job of pumping out, you know, the most optimal marijuana and providing every strain requested in a timely fashion. But I'm sorry, you know, they're right now in violation of the Controlled Substances Act, which says that NIDA has to provide a continuous and uninterrupted adequate supply of marijuana. It's not a continuous, 17 months is not a continuous supply, and it's certainly not adequate when all these strains, you know, these various phenotypes are not available. And it's just, I mean, the taxpayers have to rise up here really soon, because we can't go into phase three using NIDA marijuana. It is because that NIDA marijuana is only available for research. And when you, whatever you use in phase three, you have to go to market with that. And so they realize that they don't believe that we'll get to phase three. You know, our study is a phase two trial. So it's an early phase FDA drug development trial. If the data from phase two looks favorable, which we don't know if it will, the data may show that marijuana is not helpful for PTSD, and then the process would be over. But if the data looks, shows that marijuana is useful for PTSD, the FDA may allow us to go to phase three. And at phase three, that's the last step before the drug is on the market with an FDA indication for PTSD. So it's critical that in the next 2 years, we must dismantle the NIDA monopoly and start licensing other expert growers in the country. So I'm really eager to see that. And it's going to take, your listeners have to start reaching out to their federal elected officials. Don't waste time talking to state level officials. You need to talk to your congressmen and your U.S. senators and demand change. You have to just say that the DEA NIDA monopoly must be ended and the DEA must license other growers.
We just had Mike from ASA on the show a couple weeks ago, and we talked about Korea. We did a whole show on the Korea Act, and that will help you too, right? If we were to pass Korea in D.C., will that help your research and that help what you're trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. That CARES Act is critical to, you know, there's a whole subsection there about eliminating barriers to marijuana research, and my sponsor, MAPS, actually helped draft that entire section. So there's excellent language in there about ending the NIDA monopoly. At that point, we were talking about ending the Public Health Service review, but fortunately, after 20 years of fighting to end the PHS review, that finally happened. You guys saw a month ago that the White House announced that they were finally getting rid of that redundant review that was so effectively blocking marijuana research in this country. So that was already a big victory. Hopefully now we have some more momentum with the White House not receiving any criticism when they ended the Public Health Service review. Obama didn't receive any criticism from Republicans. So I'm hoping that will give him the courage and spur him on to the last and final step, which is ending the NIDA monopoly now. So hopefully he'll do that before the end of his term, even if the CARES Act doesn't pass. I don't know if Mike told you that, because most people seem to feel that getting the CARES Act passed is pretty unlikely. But
now, Mike was pretty optimistic about it. He said, you know, Senator Schumer co-signing on it a couple of weeks ago was a big sign of things moving forward, especially because, you know, Senator Schumer will be the next majority or minority leader in Congress. So Mike was pretty optimistic about that.
Wow, that's great. After so many months of being stalled in Judiciary Committee, we all thought it was pretty grim. So.
Well, it's still stuck there for now. It's still stuck there, but at least we're getting some very powerful co-sponsors behind it.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, it just seems so politically safe for an elected official to be on the side of marijuana research. Who's going to fault them for that? That's about, you know, I'm sad to see that it takes any political courage to have to defend science or defend marijuana research. But again, it comes back to the word marijuana, that it's just so politically radioactive, and people recoil at the mention of it, even if it's in the context of research. So,
yeah, Dr. Sisley, that is true. I mean, it's amazing the difference. I talk to a lot of politicians, the different feedback I get, and I've experimented where I've said medical cannabis versus medical marijuana to try to gauge the response. Right? I mean, we're talking about the same thing. It's just different packaging, in many ways. And you're right. I mean, there's absolutely a stigma out there. Even with my daughter, who went from, she could go roughly, she was declining, but she could go about 2 days on a good streak on pharmaceuticals, and we ended up down to a drug called Felbitol, which is not very safe. And that's when our pediatrician, who's been Alexis's pediatrician since 2007, said that if you can, you need to look at something else. Because of the profile of that drug. So I wonder if you could quantify, you've talked about the roadblocks for supply, right? And I think people don't think about that a lot. They say, okay, well, the U.S. government's been sending medical cannabis to a couple of patients that are left in the study for decades now. And so people assume that the U.S. government, whether it be through seizure or through, seizing assets and these raids, they think that the United States has some stash of medical cannabis or cannabis somewhere that you guys can just draw from. But in reality, you and I both know that's not true. So my question is, we're 5 years in now, and you still don't have all the products you need, nor do you have, it doesn't appear like you're going to get all the products you need. There's going to be a compromise in the study before we even get out of the block, so to speak. So speak a little bit about, if you would, what would have been different? Because I know every strain that I've heard about that you might be interested in, I could go down the road 15 minutes and pick them up with full labs, right? Full labs. And so, my question to you is, if that roadblock hadn't been there, to give people an idea of how much has this affected you? If it wasn't there, where would you be compared to where you are?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because, if you think about, we reached our final federal government approval back in March of last year. So March 2014, we finally got through the 3 years of waiting for the Public Health Service review to finish their process. And so at that point, we were allowed to buy marijuana study drug. And so if we were working with any expert grower in the country, they would have been able to have marijuana grown to spec for us within 3 months. But instead of being able to start in, April, May, June of last year, here we are 17 months later, still with no timeline for when the marijuana will arrive. And again, like you said, having to accept, to compromise our requests for strain science, we have to compromise our request for various phenotypes to fit NIDA's incompetence, that they don't know how to grow these different strains. They've proven that. When we first got approved in March of last year, NIDA admitted to us that they had never grown CBD-rich marijuana. That was a big revelation to people, because at that point, we had Project CBD. We had all these groups running for years that knew how to grow CBD-rich marijuana. Only NIDA had never grown it. And yet there was a huge demand for CBD-rich marijuana all over our country. So it shows you how out of step NIDA is. And so they've spent the last 17 months trying to figure out how to grow CBD-rich marijuana and how to grow the strains that we've requested. And still they don't have it, but they've come close enough to the point where we're accepting it because we don't dare delay the study anymore. The problem is that if we told them to go back to the drawing board, if we say no, 7% is not what we asked for, go back and try again, then they said, okay, well then you'll have to wait another grow cycle. And we said, well, how long is that? And they won't tell you, because they don't know or they don't want to disclose it. But the danger is that if we tell them to go back, then and we don't know how long it will take. It could take them another year. This is the problem. These federal agencies don't have any timelines which they're required to abide by, unlike the FDA, which was a joy to work with because they're on a 30-day timetable. They have to respond to every inquiry in a month. These other agencies can take as long as they want, and that's the danger. So we decided to go ahead and accept these, you know, lousy substandard phenotypes because we know that we feel all the weight of these veterans on our shoulders. Every day I wake up determined to try to find a method of getting this study going. And so we fight every day on behalf of them to say, look, we need objective data now. We're not going to wait anymore. We've done everything we can to expedite this study, to shine a spotlight on this, to make the general public aware of the injustice of these, of the stonewalling. I'm just stunned. You know, when we originally designed the study, we could have done a PTSD study focusing on all trauma victims, police, fire, vets, rape victims, anyone, but we chose to focus on military vets because we felt that this epidemic of veteran suicide was such a serious public health crisis, and we felt certain that the federal government, when they saw this, would certainly expedite a study like this. Instead of what we've discovered has really happened, instead of the government moving the study forward urgently, realizing the public health crisis, instead they have stonewalled this and impeded this study at every turn. And I think it is so shameful that the government doesn't even, you know, they're unapologetic about it. And it makes me wonder, you know, I'm glad that we did this to prove to ourselves that the government really doesn't care about this. They don't care about the veterans' suicide epidemic. They're willing to make overtures and claim that, you know, set up a new program here and there, build a new veteran center, and say that they care. But the truth is, if they cared, they would be moving this study forward at lightning speed. And 5 years later, they have done nothing but block us. So I'm disgusted, and I think that you know, every vet I talk to is absolutely infuriated by this. And it just shows you that you're not going to get help from the government. And I'm grateful to all the vets who've stood, you know, side by side with us, helping us kick down the doors of the government when they wouldn't allow this to go forward. And I'm most grateful to the media, who have been incredible allies in this process, helping to constantly expose this wrongdoing, this really bad behavior from the government, from our universities, the fact that there wasn't a single state university in Arizona that was willing to find a home for this fully funded, federally approved study. I mean, that's just insane that none of these universities wanted to create a sanctuary for this vital research. Unreal.
Yeah, and you know, I am a data geek. I am a scientist, and I'm in the healthcare field. I do data analytics and software engineering for hospitals across the country. And I find it fascinating, the numbers here, because I want to put it in perspective of our listeners. You are 5 years into this. 5 years, okay? Well, we're coming up on 16 faster than any of us want to believe, especially it's about to be winter here in Denver. None of us want to believe that. But in five more years, 2021, right? And I don't think people think enough about this. I came from an era as a disabled vet where really we were after Gulf War I, and I served in the period when what we kind of had going on was Bosnia, right? There were some other things going on, but Gulf War II hadn't gone off yet and things like that. So my generation, who I joined in 93, they're already retired at their 20 years, was the last generation by 2021, which is roughly 5 years from now. When those people retire after their 20 years, for the first time in history of this country, we will have people, if it doesn't get better by some miracle in the next 5 years, we will have people retiring from military service who have been at war, and I say at war, their entire career. And so I think that what you're doing, this front line of the PTSD battle, This number that's just above 20, I know the surveys and the numbers vary a little bit about how many are taking their own lives daily, and not to mention not all states report, which they should be federally compelled to do, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, that number is probably over 30. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's estimates up to 50. Like you said, if all states reported and if the data was accurate, because the problem is many of the vets that I've lost in my own medical practice have been labeled an accident. But I know from working with these patients and talking to their family members that these were all suicides. So it takes a lot of effort for a government, you know, a coroner's office to label something a suicide. And these guys are lazy and they don't want to go the distance, so they end up just labeling it an accident so it's easier for them to file their report and move on to the next case. So it is probably much, much higher.
Yeah, it's stunning. I mean, if you think about someone who's been at war for 20 years, I mean, I did two or three tours. I mean, some of these people will have done, you know, immeasurable number of tours. And I do know people who have PTSD, doctor, and they didn't know for years.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I met the other day, I got a call from, it's like at 2 a.m. from a 92-year-old World War II vet out of Houston, who called me and said he had a gun and he was tired of the recurrent images in his head, and he didn't know what else to do, and he'd heard about me from some of his vet friends in Texas and wondered if I could help and talk to him about possibility of using marijuana for PTSD. And I was just I'm so grateful that the information is getting around to vets, and the notion that, you know, we have so few World War II vets left with us and they're so precious, and the notion that this man he has not been able to sleep in years, and the notion that we could have been helping his suffering a long time ago, but he was just so afraid of being associated with marijuana, but he was so desperate now. So I think that is going to be a big help when we have vets like him, that hopefully we can get him some relief now, and hopefully he'll be able to talk openly about his experience. And that's what's going to change people, when we have folks like him, you know, with the courage to talk on the record about this. So we'll see how things go with him.
Yeah, that just gave me chills. Thank you again for everything you're doing, because it's definitely definitely very important, and anything we can do to help here on our side, we will. Dean, obviously, being a veteran, has some contact, and I'm sure you'll be more than happy to help. We thank you very much for your time. I'd just like to finish with one last thing, if you don't mind just talking about it. Last time I saw you was in Colorado, here in Denver, for the hearing to add PTSD as a condition, as a qualifying condition in the state of Colorado. And, you know, I never served. I don't have PTSD. And I just sat in that audience and had a really hard time holding my tears back. I mean, you know, I'm a grown man, but I'm not going to lie. That was really, really people coming and talking about how, you know, especially one vet, how he was with a noose around his neck, and somebody walk in the garage and give him a joint, and, you know, he said, I don't smoke, I don't want to do that. And his friend said, well, you're going to kill yourself in a few minutes, so why not? And he did it, and the guy is still alive now. He has two little kids. Also story from on the non-vet side, from sexual abuse people, and it was just such a sad day in Colorado, and seeing all those people opening up and sharing stories they never shared before, and then to have the board go against their scientific advisory board that voted for to add PTSD 7-2, and then 4 hours of testimony of heart-wrenching, tearful testimony, and then I think the vote was 6-2 or something like that. And I know you and I talk about this. It was just devastating. But I know you're also doing something about this. Can you talk a little bit more about what's going on to try to get PTSD added in Colorado?
Yeah, now we can talk openly because we filed our complaint. After that happened, I knew that we couldn't just rely on I know there was a lot of discussion about running a bill again through the legislature, but we all know last time that PTSD bill didn't even get out of committee. So the likelihood of that legislative path being successful seemed very small. So So we decided to do what we did in Arizona, which was, you know, after petitioning the health department so many years, we took the health department to the court, you know, and successfully sued them and got a judge to order them to add PTSD. So we knew that there was legal precedent in Arizona, and we decided to. So I just went, you know, was so fortunate to find this law firm after interviewing, I don't know, 6 or 7 different law firms, that all of them rejected it, saying either they certainly wouldn't take the case pro bono, or and they would not, they didn't even feel that we had a legal standing. And we managed to find Hoban and Fiola, a very small, dedicated firm who, when they heard the story, they did weeks and weeks of legal research to try to decide if this case was winnable. And they agreed to take it, you know, pro bono. And we've been really, we've assembled a group of 5 exquisite plaintiffs, 4 of them veterans, 1 non-vet, and they are doing a great job. We filed our complaint last week. We should hear, we're required to hear a response from the district court in about 2 more weeks. So it was great to see Colorado show that they're not going to just roll over. And, you know, there's good people on the ground there that are, you know, ready to fight for this. And I think they're still pursuing the legislative option as a backup plan in case, you know, you never know when you go through the court system if you're going to find a judge who's sympathetic or not. But we're hoping, this is a very different environment than Arizona, and that, like you said, the big difference is that both the health department director and the scientific advisory council went on record to support adding PTSD. That's completely different than Arizona, where everyone was opposed. So I think that we're going to, you know, come out victorious. I'm not a plaintiff. I'm just serving as scientific, you know, expert witness, whatever you want, a scientific consultant for them. And I've just been providing them all the scientific literature and things to back up the case. But I'm thrilled to see that we're not just going to, the Board of Health needs to be, you know, they need to, they were clearly not well informed. And I think what was frustrating for people was that, you know, cutting people off at 2 minutes, yeah. You know, unfortunately some of this testimony needed to be heard, and you can't do much in 2 minutes. So that's why we have a judicial process where a judge can look at the entire weight of the existing scientific literature combined with patient testimony, combined with medical testimony, and see. So hopefully we'll have some good news for you. And I know we're doing a big event on October 15th at the Denver VFW. So if any of your listeners want to come out, the first VFW in the country in Denver is going to be hosting a big, you know, panel discussion on PTSD, and we've invited the law firm to come and share an update with the public and things like that. So would love to have everyone.
Yeah, no, that's great. We'll make sure we'll share the details on the air when you get closer to it.
You got it.
Dr. Sisley, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for everything you've been doing and for not giving up. I think that's a key. I know a lot of people in your position would have said, I don't need this in my life, and, you know, it's not going to happen. But I think, again, I'm not a vet, but I think all the vets are very thankful, and all the people on the outside that are seeing this are very thankful when you're not giving up and you keep on pushing. And I know it's been very hard on you also in your own life and your job and everything. So we greatly appreciate all you do, and we just want you to know that, make sure you know that. And we will have you back in the show anytime, maybe in a few weeks or months, to get an update on the lawsuit and on your research study, which hopefully you can start very soon.
Thank you guys so much for those kind words. That means the world to me. And I'm so glad, Dean, that Alexis is finding relief with this treatment. And for you too, Sebastian, your family, everybody who's teaching the world about this, we're grateful to you as pioneers. So we'll look forward to coming back on the show later. And thank you again.
Yeah, we can't thank you enough. And on behalf of veterans, I mean, it's amazing what you're doing, and so keep up the good fight. Anything I can do to help, or anything Alexis can do to help, anytime you're in Colorado, the Denver area, you make sure reach out to us, and anything you need, we're there.
Oh, thank you all. You're both terrific. Thank you, guys.
You have a great day, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so that wraps the interview with Dr. Cicely. We're going to do a little back and forth because we don't have a second half to that interview. So we need to do the – it's going to be broken up a little bit. So we'll get started on that in just a second. Okay, for everybody watching on YouTube, it's going to get really weird. So just bear with us, because what you're going to see now, I see flashing. What's the flashing on the camera?
What do you see flashing? Oh, battery.
Oh, I got to do a battery swap. Be right back. Okay, we're back. You don't have video yet. It's coming. There it is. Okay, we're back. We're going to need to zoom in. I'll get it.
I think that's where you had it. I'll just move this out of the... product on the show.
No, she wants to zoom in. Oh, man. Can you flip that thing around? I see the red thing. Sorry, folks. We're all kinds of confused here right now. Yeah, we're good. Okay, we should be back online. And we are. Okay. Okay, so for those of you, again, who are hanging out on YouTube, we thank you. It's going to be a little weird because we did the interview with Dr. Cicely, and now we're kind of, the magic of editing is about to happen. So we're going to intro the show. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on, and then we're going to cut, and then we're going to do what would happen after the interview, which is a couple minutes to close out the show and then take us out. So, to quote the wonderful Captain Kirk. All right. So let me make sure that we're good and that we don't have any channels we don't need making noise, and we're good. Got a good clean audio. And I know there's people listening. I'm sure they're listening on cells because they're commenting, and I know for a fact that they're in between locations at the present point. So hello, everyone who are mobile. Okay, so let's get started here. We're going to take a quick second to pause, and then I'm going to do the intro. Welcome back, everybody. It's your humble host, Dean Bortel, here with co-host Sebastian. We are here with the Canatix Political Smoke and Mirrors Hour, part of the Millennium Broadcast Network's show lineup. We welcome you back to the show. We got an exciting show, right, Sebastian?
We sure do. We have a very special guest today.
Yeah, we got Dr. Sue Cicely of, she's been doing it much before, but of Weed 3 fame. She was featured in Weed 3 as part of the Veterans PTSD study that she's still trying to get off the ground. We're going to talk about that. As I understand it, she's about 5 years in.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and still doesn't have the medicine. It's absolutely ridiculous. So she'll definitely educate us on that. We have no doubt. And we'll cover that in detail. I have a funny feeling that she's going to talk a little while, which is great. It's exactly what we want. So it may take up a lot of the hour. So we'll enjoy that interview. But let's talk a little bit about veterans. I know there's a veterans show that I have the honor of being part of on the network, the 1620 Talk Show, as you know about. PTSD on their show for launch week was a big subject, and I think overall in the veteran community it's a big subject, but I think it goes beyond that, and I want to get your feedback on something because this is not veteran related. I had a doctor once tell me, and I'm a disabled vet, but I'm not being treated for PTSD or anything. I mean, these kids, and that's what they are. I mean, I just passed 40. These kids serving this last 15 years in a constant state of war are the real heroes. I mean, what they're going through is unbelievable. But I talked to a doctor, and I don't know how we got into it or whatever, but we got on the subject of my daughter and various things. I'm finding now as I walk in more and more places, they kind of know what's going on with Lex and things like that. But this doctor obviously had it figured out, and we were talking about medical cannabis and PTSD. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I said I was a disabled vet. I didn't say I was being treated for PTSD. And this doctor said, you know, as a parent of a special needs child, that over half of the people with special needs children would test in the test for PTSD markers, would come back and say that they at least showed symptoms of PTSD. I wonder what do you think of that? As someone who's not a veteran, but you are a parent of a special needs child.
You know, that's very interesting because I just had a conversation with my wife not long ago, and I think we have kind of the same conversation, but we probably have some symptoms. And, you know, to me, it's I travel for work. I try not to so much, but I do. I have a job. I'm in sales. I have a job where I have to travel. And first of all, I want to put a disclaimer. I don't want to compare this with anything about going to war or anything like this. This is not even close, okay? But if you talk about the definition of PTSD and what it does, I do wake up sometime in the middle of the night in a hotel. I might be in Chicago or in New York or wherever work take me, because I think I hear my son Jagger's pulse ox alert going off because his oxygen is low, very low. And I would wake up in panic in the middle of the night, and I look around and I'm like, what is wrong with me? I'm in a hotel in New York right now. What? Jagger's not even here. And so that is considered a symptom of PTSD.
Yes, it is.
And now, again, I don't believe I have PTSD, and you know, it's nothing that is taking over my life like it does for some of us veterans. It's definitely not as severe. But many special need parents do have PTSD. You know, it's very true. I mean, it's very difficult to be a special need parent. You know, in our case, with our kid being on hospice and being hooked up to a machine every single day, every second of every day, it's even a little bit more dramatic. But we are used to it, so we know that. But we do sometimes wake up in the middle of the night, or, you know, hearing thing, or worrying about him when he's doing totally fine right next to us. So I do believe a lot of parents, you know, have PTSD symptom. And to the same thing, it's not just something that only veterans have. Obviously, it's the most publicized because of the veterans unfortunately taking their life every day, which I'm sure we'll talk to Dr. Sisley about that. You know, some numbers are varied, and the big push right now is saying 22, but we all know it's more than 22,
right?
Unfortunately. At the hearing a few weeks ago in Colorado, in Denver, about adding PTSD to the medical condition, there were sexual abuse women that were sexual abused as child or by their husband or boyfriend that also testified with horrible PTSD that were also helped by using cannabis and helping with the nightmare and the night sweat and the night terrors. So it's not a veteran-only issue. It's affecting a lot of people. And while the biggest push should absolutely be on the veteran side, because they are the one that is suffering the worst from it and have the worst, you know, I can never imagine, never do I want to imagine what it is to be in a war zone. And I hope to God that I never will see that in my life. So I can't even relate to what they're doing. But PTSD will help if we can pass anywhere, maybe starting with Colorado, and then, you know, Dr. Sisley's study, then I'm sure she will talk in depth about. If we can pass this, it would help not just veteran, but it would help sexual abuse people, rape victim, special need parents victim, a car accident victim. It would help so many people. So, you know, it's once again, it's something we're doing here, and it's a question of life or death, and it's not just for a few kids. You know, it's not just seizure kids or, you know, Crohn patient. This is for a lot of people, and that could absolutely help a ton of people.
Yeah, and you're talking about something. I like to bring this up to politicians I talk to, and yes, they will talk to me still.
For now.
Yeah, some of them, for now. But I put an open invitation to any politician out there that wants to talk on any side of the issue. Send us a message.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're more than willing. I don't care what side you're on. It's about the conversation, right? Let's talk about it. Let's find out where you stand. But what's really interesting with the PTSD and the veterans, they really have, and the kids, let's throw the kids in there too. This argument has transformed, because a prohibitionist for decades, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories out there about why cannabis and marijuana became illegal. I mean, some of them say it was racial, some of them say it was corporate. I don't necessarily take any of those viewpoints, but what is interesting is if you follow the prohibitionist, their methodology for keeping cannabis Schedule One, where you can't do medical research on it, not even admitting it's a medicine, their strategy has evolved as society has evolved. They no longer use the same reasons that they used in the 30s to get it out of the... It used to be in the pharmacopoeia. It used to be a pharmaceutical,
sure,
right? I'm trying, you know, for anyone out there, a selfless plug, I'm trying to get one of those old bottles, you know, on eBay, but they are, wow, that's
a collectible
bottle.
Item.
Yeah, they're collectible, the old elixirs and stuff. But as you look at history and you say, okay, well, in the 30s, they said it was you know, violent crimes, people, again, coming over the border, bringing it. You hear some mentions of that again starting to surface, which is unfortunate. But, you know, there's no discounting that drugs do come across the border. But that's not the main problem. The main problem is prohibition itself. That's what spawns all of this bad behavior. So I think that Dr. Sicily is going to have some great insight on that, and I look forward to it. One thing I do want to mention, and this came in over the wire, and then I was supplied a handout, but here in Denver, for those of you that are in the Denver, Lone Tree, any of the areas around here, the Chelsea Hutchison Foundation is having a walk run 5K. Now you look at me and I'm not running. It's obvious.
You can walk it.
I can walk it, man. I'm over 5,000 feet, so that's like running, right? In Texas, that would be like going for a jog in Texas. A nice walk here at 5K plus. So they've got on September 13th. They've got a 5K family walk run. It's going to be a 7:30 a.m. registration with a 9 a.m. Start time, and this is going to happen at Clement Park. And that's in Littleton, and that's on September 13th, Clement Park, 7706 West Bowles Avenue. And that is, again, 7:30, registration starts, 9 a.m., the walk starts, and it's September 13th, 2015. And why Chelsea Hutchison? Who is she? What's the foundation? The story is rather heartbreaking. Chelsea was very... And I don't want to put kids on top of kids here in the deal, but she was very much like Alexis, where her epilepsy, she was an epileptic, and her epilepsy wasn't, as I understand it, has been explained to me in what's like Dravet's, the catastrophic stuff. But yet, and this underscores how critical these fights are for medical liberties and freedom. You know, she tragically passed away from a condition known as SUDEP, you know, sudden unexplained death from epilepsy. And it just goes to show you that one seizure can be fatal. And I think people lose track of that. They see these stories, and some of them attached to companies, some of them not, of kids who suffer from catastrophic forms of epilepsy. But I think what's happened is that it's all got lumped together, and people kind of forget that it only takes one, like with PTSD. I mean, you can have someone who's got bad PTSD, and I know a lot of people with PTSD working in the veterans community. You know, these 22 suicides a day, it would be an interesting statistic to see how many of them people knew were coming. I think a lot of it's spontaneous. I think that these people can be saved, and I think it's an absolute travesty that we're not doing everything we can to get the studies done, right? I'm not saying open the floodgates. I'm saying let's give people access and let's monitor.
That's what Dr. Sicily will be talking. That's what Dr. Sicily will be talking about, and we're very eager to see how she's doing on her study and what's going on, because we all know. I mean, it's been pretty publicized, and she's getting a lot of hurdle to jump over to try to get that. So we're really looking forward to hear the letters, and hopefully, it will be good news. We're looking forward to that in just a few minutes.
Yeah, and this is coming in some of the comments, and we certainly welcome them coming in, and people talking about assault and rape victims that have PTSD and things like that, and you're absolutely correct. I mean, PTSD exists, I would say, across the spectrum. It doesn't matter who you are, what your physician is, what your occupation is, race, anything. I mean, PTSD, illness, medical, they just don't know any boundaries. I mean, it's not, as we say on this show a lot, this show is about politics, but when you get down to medical cannabis is not about politics, it's about human rights. And so that doesn't make me a hypocrite. You'll hear me say on this show over and over and over again, states rights, and Dean, why did you turn on us? Now you're talking about federal, that the federal government needs to get involved and tell states what to do. Well, this is different, because you're talking here about a basic human right. And there is precedent for that, the Bill of Rights, things like that. So this would, I would argue, even me being a fairly limited government guy, that this is absolutely something the federal government has to take a scientific look at. So
hopefully, you know, we're getting closer every day. Hopefully.
I think we are. Yeah. People like Dr. Sicily and others. You know, I think Dr. Doblin. There's several of them out there that are working together, and that's what it is. It's about uniting, not dividing. It's about truth and not rhetoric, and it's about history versus the last 80 years, let's say. Let's look at the 1,000 years before it, not the 80 years of prohibition. So history plays in, too. So let's not forget where we came from with this plant. I mean, we keep calling it medicine, but people, it's a little bit simpler than that's a plant.
It's just a plant.
Just a plant. So it works for some, not for everybody. And as long as you keep that in mind, I think anybody can have a civil conversation, minus a handful I've met.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you're always going to have people that think you're the devil, but that's okay. Okay, so we're going to take us to break. We're going to come right back with the one and only Dr. Sue Sicily, who is out there on the front lines of this struggle with NIDA and you know, some other health organizations here in the U.S. The VA, as I understand, has not been too friendly. She'll probably go into that.
I'm a friend of hers.
Yeah, so we'll be right back. She'll join us. And then after her segment, we'll talk a little bit about it, and we'll wind down. But I have a funny feeling this interview is going to go for a little while. So we'll talk to you on the other side of the commercials. Again, you're listening to the Smoke and Mirrors Hour, the Canatix Show on the Millennium Grown Network. We'll be right back. Okay, now it's going to get weirder, YouTube, because now we're going to record the takeout, which is the period after the interview. So Sebastian's going to bring us back in with the intro. Dr. Sicily's interview will be edited in at this point. So whenever you're ready, Sebastian, we'll go for about 5 minutes.
Well, once again, we want to thank Dr. Sue Sicily. That was just great stuff. I mean, the passion and the care that she has for everybody and for the veteran is just amazing. And just sitting here, when she's talking about this 92-year-old World War II vet, I just got chills. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And the fact that this vet that done so much for our country is still alive today, just probably in big part because he was able to reach to Sue, and she was able to direct him the right way. I mean, that's just amazing. Pure gold, pure radio gold. We will keep everybody updated, of course, on the effort. We will hope we'll have Dr. Sicily a few more time on the show, both talking about her study and then talking about this lawsuit, which that was also a very interesting turn. This lawsuit now in the state of Colorado, that's the approach that worked in Arizona. So we're really, really hoping that it works in Colorado. And like I said during the interview, I was actually sitting in that room, and it was heartbreaking. I mean, totally heartbreaking to see the vets and non-vets alike just pouring their heart out. And, you know, so our work is very important. Obviously, some others, as you said, Dean, before the interview, are also doing great work on this. But she's in the front line, and I can tell you, I have the honor to know her for the last year or so. She is not going anywhere, and she's not giving up. She put a lot of her personal life on the line, and many things happened in her life, and she doesn't like to talk about.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're not going to bring it up on this show, but you can obviously do your own research.
You can Google it. It's all over Google.
It's all over the Googles, as we call them at work. That she has sacrificed heavily for her beliefs.
Yeah.
And her convictions, not beliefs. They're not beliefs.
No, they're not beliefs.
She's going into it.
She's going into
herself.
Scientist, yes.
Yeah. She said for herself, she has no expectations.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because it's something that's missing. You can't do it.
I can't
do it. I'm tainted.
No, I already got expectation, and I'm biased already. It's too late for me.
Too late for me. I mean, you know, I've seen what it's done for Alexis. And look, those people that can stay objective, they're vital. And she's passionate, but yet she's objective, and that is a couple of qualities, especially within the medical community, which I've been working in for nearly 15 years. They don't go hand in hand a whole lot.
No, they don't.
You know, it's a rare trait to have those two together. And so, I had not talked to her much before this interview. I knew a lot about her through the research, but didn't know much about some of the roadblocks she's faced. I can't believe that, you know, Dr. Volkoff, NIDA, right?
Yep.
She goes on CNN, if you'll remember, we two, where she's acting like, and even we three, and I, this is probably magic of editing again, but when you talk to her, or not talk to her, when you watch her on TV, remember you're not a participant. People forget that too. When you're watching something on TV, that doesn't make you an activist. It came across that Dr. Volkoff was kind of for medical cannabis research. You know, almost like she was softening a bit, melting that ice layer, if you will. But I get from Dr. Sisley that maybe
we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, that may be public persona versus, you know, what really happens when that door is closed.
Yeah, it would be great to be a fly on that wall.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not going to happen. So we have to take, I think we have to take everything she said with a grain of salt. And we've seen that with Dr. Sisley, you know, just begging for specific kind of cannabis and not being able to get it. It's shameful, really, because, you know, she made a great point. It's your tax money, my tax money, everybody here listening, tax money. But, you know, we're not asking for much. I mean, Dr. Sisley's not been asking for much. I don't believe getting four different kind of cannabis is asking for much at all. And not be able to get something, and Dean made a good point, something that we can leave the studio right now, get in a car, and in about 15 minutes, probably even less than that, we could get the four or three kind, because one is placebo. We could get the three kind of cannabis that Dr. Sisley needs for her research. We could get that to her and probably overnight it. I mean, obviously, if it wasn't illegal.
Yeah, exactly.
But we could buy enough, overnight it, get it tested. Some of the tests would already come with it. And, you know, she could start a study tomorrow morning. But she can't, because it has to come from NIDA. It has to come from, you know, the government, and it has to be grown in University of Mississippi, and we don't know how it's being grown. She made that point. She said, we told her it's organic, but anybody can flop an organic label on anything.
Right, right. So, yeah, and, you know, there was two things that stood out about that interview to me, and one question I really dropped the ball on. I wish I'd have asked her.
We get her back.
Yeah,
she'll come back.
So she's going to listen, I'm sure, so I'm going to give her a hint about the question I'm going to ask. I've worked, whether it be a good thing or a bad thing, with and around the government, being a veteran a lot. And in healthcare, a lot of grants and various things early in my career I was involved with. So one thing I've seen before, and I hope they're not pulling this. God, I hope this isn't what's going on. But she specifically said that one of the specific medications she wanted was, I think it was close to 20% CBD or 12% CBD, 12% THC.
That's what she wanted.
And
for the
federal government, the federal government came in and said, no, we can only give you 7% and 7%. I hope it's not a bait and switch. And what I mean is, I hope that they don't come back and say, okay, well, now that this medicine's available, it's not what you put your original proposal for the study in for. So you have to resubmit the study because you're using different mediums as the medications.
I'll not put it past the government that.
No,
so.
And I should have asked her. I totally messed up.
I'm sure that's in the back of her mind.
Yeah,
she's pretty smart. I'm sure she already got all those angles covered, but that's a good point. I mean, you know, technically, when you do a study, and I don't know a ton about study, I know a lot of people that are in research, but when you do that, you know, you have to follow your FDA protocol, and if you change anything on your protocol, then you have to... you know, you have to do, you have to make changes and amendment to your study. So, and hopefully that will not be the one thing that will hold up approval. The other worry with that to me is then, if they say, for example, if they show good result with that 1-to-1 ratio at 7%, then nothing else but 7% will be approved for the veteran.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to get 7% in a state that grow cannabis. It's actually harder to get a low percentage and a high percentage in the state that grow cannabis, like Colorado. You know, if you were just looking at a THC plant and you want to get a 20 or 25% THC, you can get that in any dispensary. But if you walk in a dispensary and ask for a 7% plant or 8%, it's a lot harder to get.
Yeah, I'm sitting here trying to think of a single strain I know of that falls under 10%.
I mean, unless you have CBD on it, so it would be like maybe an ACDC, but just THC, I don't know.
Yeah, I know ACDC is pretty high CBD.
And then you get probably less than 10, you know, I mean, there's some strain, but they won't be just THC.
Right.
And that's be maybe a good topic for Nick and Mike on the Strain Talk show.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can submit that to them for the next show.
Yeah, they actually were talking on one of their shows recently about strains. And this is another problem with the study, which is not Dr. Sisley's fault.
Yeah, we don't know the strain.
If you grow a strain, and don't accuse me of being a hippie or pothead because I know a lot about cannabis, My daughter's a patient. I'd be a moron if I hadn't done the research. But let's say you have a strain that works. I'm just going to pick a strain out of the air, someone none of us are affiliated with. It doesn't mean it's great. But and Alexis is not taking this strain because it's really powerful. But let's say Vanilla Kush, right? Vanilla Kush, a pretty popular strain, yep. Very powerful, used for pain relief. A lot of people use it at night before yep. bed. Very, very powerful. It's
very helpful for a lot of people.
For a lot of people, love Vanilla Kush. Hard to get, but people love it. But the point is that if you grow, and they were talking about this on Strain Talk, if you grow that plant, let's say in Mississippi, down near sea level, right? And the structure of that plant, the terpenes, the cannabinoids, and all of these other parts that make it up, and then you grow that exact same seed in Colorado at 5,000 feet in the High Plains Desert, the profile is going to be different. So not only is she getting medication from down near sea level and going to test it not near sea level, but when the study comes out, what I'm afraid of is, given that we know that the plant is different between two geographic locations, we still run into the issue of, where do you source the medicine?
Yeah.
You know, is the U.S. government going to get into the business of distributing medical marijuana, and they're going to grow it all in Mississippi or somewhere or on a military base?
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Or are they going to say, okay, well, you know, in this region, this is the profile for, let's say, Vanilla Kush. But if you're in Colorado or you're in somewhere that the relative humidity is under 40%,
it makes a difference.
It's a different strain. So it's going to be really, unfortunately, it's going to be a very bumpy ride.
It is. And, you know, the other thing too, and I think that's a comment from one of our listeners here. So thank you for the comment, because that's a very good point. I said to Dr. Sisley's presentation a few times, one in American for Safe Access conference in D.C. and once at some kind of symposium in Denver a few months back. And one part, we didn't bring that up with her. She already gave us so much time. I didn't want to bring so many things.
And we wanted her to come back.
We do want her to come back. One thing she shows in her presentation, if you ever have a chance to see her speak live, she has a great presentation and she's absolutely amazing. But one thing she shows is some of the marijuana or cannabis they got from NIDA, they actually came in some kind of joint form or in bulk, and they opened it and looked at it, and she has a picture of it, and that's so telling. And if you look at that picture, it is mostly trim. There's very little flower in it. And that's a huge worry also, because, you know, not to go all technical again, this is not a technical strain talk show, but there's a big difference in the content and in the percentage of cannabinoids, between a flower and a trim. Trim is mostly what people call either tiny, tiny buds or the leaf, the sugar leaf, right, which are next to the, you know, there's a place for trim. You can make many things like hash or things like this. But more than likely, you won't smoke a lot of trim.
Right.
And then it doesn't have the highest percentage. You can juice trim. That's great. And for juicing, it's great. But when you're looking at a study that is a smoking study, if the product is mostly composed of trim, then now you are totally getting potential false result. Because smoking trim and smoking flower is two very different different thing that will lead to two different results. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but it's very easy to see when you see the picture for our presentation that it's very low grade quality, as one of our listener just pointed out. So thank you for bringing that point to us. But it's very true. And that's a concern. So that's another thing to talk to her about next time.
And here's the question I have. If NIDA develops the strain that she's doing the study on, because the way it works, people, is that you have to go to NIDA, you say, I want this medicine, and then they say, okay, we either have it or we don't. But if it's a strain that they have not developed, they don't go out to a grower in Colorado and say, I need this strain, and then I'm going to grow it in Mississippi. They don't do that.
No, it'd be too easy.
It wouldn't cost enough, right? It's a federal government. It wouldn't cost enough. So what they do is they say, okay, we are going to reverse engineer this genetic plant for you. But my question is, do they then own that strain? Nobody's talking about that, because technically
they
would.
That's a good question.
If the originator, and this may be how we get it out, is for whoever developed, let's say, that strain or a set strain, that, because obviously they're trying to get a certain profile of cannabinoids and terpenes and various things in the plant. But she said NIDA didn't test all that. You only get CBD and THC, so you're ignoring over half the spectrum.
You are.
So at best case, you get a medicine that's half of what you want, or at least half of the knowns. Perhaps you get lucky and you get everything you want.
But then you don't know what's in it.
Then you don't know what's in it. You're just luck, just dumb luck, right? And one of the requirements for a scientific study is that it's repeatable.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
That is a requirement of a good scientific study. Some would say it has to be double blind, but in an epileptic, that's just lunacy there. You couldn't do it. Dr. Minahan has a great way of doing it, but a simpleton, like, I couldn't do it. But, you know, it's a great debate. I think her comments were spot on, but I think they're more indicative of how this is the beginning of the fight.
Yes.
It's not even the midpoint.
No.
I mean, she has no medicine in hand.
No, and she's been...
She has a promise from the government.
Over 5 years, right?
Yeah.
What she say. And,
yeah.
And, you know, another thing that was really telling to me is... a lot of people blame the FDA, but from her experience, the FDA, she actually says she loved to work with the FDA every day because the FDA has, by law, 30 days, I think this is what she say,
yeah,
to answer her. And they did answer her in 30 days.
Yeah, and if you watch Weed 3, which was good. It wasn't...
If you know how to look at it.
If you know how to look at it. Yeah, being inside now, having done this a
while. It's very different being on the inside.
I remember being in Texas watching the Weed series and going, oh my gosh, you know. And having,
you only knew.
Yeah, if you only knew. If I only knew then what I know now. But in Weed 3, what they brought up is they said, okay, well, you know, she's out doing this research. Knight is going to give it to her. But they did one thing, and I think it doesn't stand out enough. If you go back and watch it again, which I urge you
to do. I probably have to now.
they interviewed one of the deputy directors from the FDA. And so the scene, just so you know you're watching the right things, Dr. Gupta and this guy is basically on this darkened tile floor, and it's obviously filmed in some corridor. They probably had 100 people locked out of why they did the interview. But it was interesting that he said that they definitely want this plant studied. They want to know what type of medicine it is, dosing and various things like that. But the Nida lady, now that I'm thinking back on it, she never did say that. She seemed like she had melted a little bit and warmed a little bit, but she didn't go like the FDA did, which that matches exactly what Dr. Sicily just told us.
Yeah, no, he sure did, and I'm gonna have to look at it again now.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to watch it again. Yeah. Lex is gonna be like, really? I've got this memorized. She has all three of them memorized. She loves, and I want to give a huge shout out to Vivi and Brian Wilson.
Yes, and actually, you know what? I think we might be able to get them on the show one of those days.
Yeah, I think
Brian has been
I've talked to him.
Brian's been very active, you know, in Jersey, obviously, with his good controversy with Governor Christie, and everybody knows about now.
Yeah.
But he's also been very active here in Colorado, trying to change the law, the lab testing laws, and many laws. He's been great in Colorado.
Yeah.
So
protecting oil making.
Yeah, the oil making, the butane ban, and now in Colorado Springs, any extraction other than ice water ban.
But only on the cannabis plant.
Yes.
That's the lunacy of the law. If I grow peppermint or anything, I can still use butane and
well, I cannot wait for you to give me some peppermint extracted peppermint oil. That would be butane extracted peppermint oil. That just sounds so good.
Yeah, I think I got some bottles for my testimony, empty bottles, because you can't have
bottles that
have had product in them. So maybe I will get one of my friends who you know to put some peppermint extract in it.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not? You know?
Why not?
God knows they'd like to talk to me about it. So. We're running out of time here. It's been amazing. It's been a great deal of fun. I want to thank Sebastian. I want to thank Dr. Sue Sicily. I want to thank most of all of the veterans out there who've laid your butts on the line for this country. Doesn't matter where you've been, what you've done. All of you signed a contract that said that you're willing to pay up to and including your life. And so it doesn't matter where you served, who you served with, what your religion, creed, or anything is. You volunteered. And for that, we salute you. So until next time, this is the Smoke and Mirrors Hour, and we are signing off. Take care. We'll see you.